We acknowledge the traditional owners of the land on which this podcast is recorded. We pay our respects to their elders, past and present, and to Aboriginal elders emerging. Special announcement for Ron Idles and Charlie Bazina fans of Melbourne. You need to know that we're doing more live shows in October, and those fellows are the stars. This time the shows are at the Yarraville Club, and tickets are on sale now. The links are on our social media pages and on our website, AustralianTrueCrimePodcast.com, or you can go straight to YarravilleClub.com and buy the tickets there right now. Yes, we are definitely coming to other cities very, very soon. Thank you to all of our new patrons, Jenny McCusker, Sharon Meyer, Julie Martin, Pauline Stephen, Lisa Marie Gibbs, Imka, Matt Lambert. Hello, Matt. I know we chatted on YouTube the other night. Good stuff. Me, Anth, Mel, Tara Kielty, Jessica Canty, Anne Bailey, Caro Burner, Chloe Williams, Em Malone, Crystal Rose, Melissa Kaustley, Tanya Berg, Christy Keister, and Kimberly Kanagesh. That is such a cool name. Thank you so much for signing up. Charlie Bazina is the man of the moment this week, actually, because not only is he our guest on the main podcast, but our patrons can also expect an extra episode this week from Charlie, in which, among other things, he explains the sentence recently handed down to Boris Rostevsky. Boris pleaded guilty to the manslaughter of his wife Karen, eventually, and was then sentenced to a maximum of 9 years in prison with a minimum of 6, which shocked a lot of us, but not Charlie. He'll explain how sentencing works in an exclusive extra episode for our patrons, which is out this weekend. You can become a patron and get your hands on some of those extra episodes by going to patreon.com/AustTrueCrime, that's A-U-S-T, Aust True Crime Pod, and for $5 American a month, you too will receive extra episodes and the keys to our hearts. Thank you so much to all of our supporters. Okay, on with the show. The following podcast contains content of a graphic, violent nature and is not suitable for children.
That apart from us supporting deceased families, we also support offenders' families. It's like coming to your home and saying, well, look, Michelle, we've just locked up your son for a murder. Well, you're reeling back. Mm. And so we had those two. We're supporting the two sides until they tell us, well, no, we don't want you to take a flying hike. And we would then support them and say what how the process is going to work from this point forward. So,
how often, though, would you get families of offenders who would have the sort of reaction of, we've been waiting for this, who would have sons or daughters who have been either dealing with mental illness or who've been off the rails and who would sort of collapse in that horrible feeling?
Yeah, well, probably in my day there was a small percentage, and it's, I think it's probably increasing now because of the drug and ice and that type of thing. Mm. And unfortunately, you know, we're getting murders now on a daily basis. And I just got a text on my phone walking here that there was a woman's body found in Parkville just this morning. And, you know, the frequency is alarming. And it wasn't really in my day, but I think now more so that a lot of parents and families got the stories of having a member of the family on ice, or they've fallen on very hard times, and you go to them and say, look, yeah, that doesn't surprise me, and away we go from there. So it's sad, sad.
Charlie Bazina was a copper for 38 years and still has a funny way of knowing a lot about what's going on around town, even though technically he's been retired since 2009. But that's another story. In a career full of high-profile cases, the one Charlie tells us about in this episode stands out for a number of reasons. The victim is internationally famous. The perpetrator is unbearably remorseful, and Charlie and the public prosecutor set about to use this case to change the law of the land.
This is Australian True Crime with Michelle Laurie and Emily Webb. Come with us as we explore how people become killers, how people become victims, and what happens next.
This is the case of the death of Australian cricket legend David Hookes, who was drinking at the Beaconsfield Hotel in St Kilda on the night of the 18th of January 2004. He was with the members of the Victorian cricket team whom he coached and the South Australian cricket team whom they defeated that day in an ING Cup match. For Charlie, the case began, as most cases did, with a late night phone call.
It was about 10 o'clock at night, and we, anyone high profile that gets killed unnaturally, we get alerted to. It's like when I did Alphonse Gangitano, there was a mass influence of police, any high profile person, and I just happened to be the on call senior sergeant that particular night. And when I took that call, and your first question is, well, who was the deceased? At that stage, he wasn't deceased. They're saying, look, this guy's been taken to hospital. He's on life support. He looks like he's not going to survive, hence our involvement. So he's certainly alive then. But given the prognosis from the Alfred Hospital, we would respond, and we did. And when they said, look, it's David Hooks. Wow. Not that the person who is injured or is deceased makes any difference, because it's the same level of investigation, whether it's the drug user down the street or someone who's a criminal, doesn't really matter. The same level of investigation takes place. However, we know something like this is going to be high profile, high media, and then away we went. So out to the crime scene. At that stage, the local police had arrested a bouncer from the Beaconsfield Hotel, a fellow called Zdravko Misevic, and he was charged with the assault upon David, and it was my job to see where that would then go. And even if I run those particular jobs, and we hold on hope every time that a miracle happens and they survive is the best outcome, but we proceed. And let's say David survived, I would then just pass on the investigation back to the local detectives. But unfortunately, in this case, the prognosis was very bleak, and I then started off the investigation.
Stravko was 22?
Yeah.
What was his state of mind at that stage? I'm imagining he's very young. Imagining he's pretty upset himself.
Yeah, very much so. Now, he didn't know who David was. He didn't know who these groups were. So you got two groups, a number of groups. You've got the Victorian cricketers and also the South Australian. They just finished the game that particular day. And as sports people do, they went to the Beaconsfield Hotel, a very nice hotel down at Beaconsfield Parade near St Kilda, and they were just having a few beers, and, it just annoys me that people that pick things are saying, the sports, they would have been drunk, they would have done this. Well, nothing could be further from the truth. It's like getting the facts from a court hearing. Don't criticise until you know the facts, and the facts were the guys were doing nothing wrong, and certainly here's a particular investigation that I become very supportive of Zdravko and also his father. And they were beside themselves of saying, regardless of him not knowing who David was and who this group were, that was well-known sports people, he was shattered in the fact that because he is a bouncer, and as we know, bouncers from time to time get involved in fracases and pushing and shoving and an assault or a fight, nothing happens. And here's one particular occasion where this has occurred, and Zdravko had delivered a blow that subsequently led to he's falling on the roadway, head injury, and he was devastated, and never been in trouble with the police before, and I'm pretty confident since.
So what led up to it then? If the cricketers weren't particularly drunk and unruly, if Zdravko's not a particularly aggressive dude, what led to this?
We never got to the bottom of it, because ultimately David was having a quiet couple of beers with a couple of his associates, and some lady people were also present, doing nothing wrong. Darren Lehman was there with a South Australian team, and just having a pleasant evening. And obviously there was other patrons in the hotel. And as the time went on, either getting to the end of the licence to say, well, okay, guys, drink up, and we don't want you to leave. And then I think Zdravko was pushing the envelope a little bit with a woman who was drinking with David, of saying, well, come on, scull it. And David took a little bit of umbrage to that and said, well, hang on, you know, we'll finish our drink. We're going to go. No problems. We'll just got to. And they're entitled to finish their drinks.
Right.
You know, they're well within the license. And so he was pushing the envelope a little bit and, you know, who knows what was going through Strafco's mind at the time. But ultimately, the guy said, well, look, you know, we'll get there. We'll be leaving. And then inexplicably, Zdravko basically grabbed David and started frog marching him out of the hotel because the other cricketers then followed. Now, there was no resistance from David, and he may have been saying, well, no, look, that's not appropriate. You ask this woman to scull a drink and all this stuff. We're going to finish our drinks. And whether Zdravko took umbrage to that and said, well, I know, I'm the boss here. I know what goes on. I'll call the shots, not you. Mm. Whether it becomes, because there's probably another, I suppose, three other bouncers there that were working with them and that, in different areas. So it becomes, you know, unfortunately a bit of a bravado thing.
Yep.
It could have been that.
Well, can I say this to you, Charlie? As a lady, I'm hearing a lot of macho bullshit, you know?
Correct.
Yeah, I'm feeling like, okay, we've got a man here who is a famous sportsman, has been for a long time. He's there with a lot of mates.
Correct.
He doesn't want to look foolish. And Andy's with a lady.
Yeah.
So he doesn't want to look foolish and be made a fool of by a young, fit bouncer. We've got a young man who is the bouncer. He doesn't want to be made to look foolish by an old guy on his own turf.
Yep.
Butting heads like a pair of rams.
Yep.
And generational stuff. Yes. So David Hook's, it's sort of old school stuff. And
Yeah, true.
And Mitchevich is young, doesn't even know who Hooksy and the other guys are. So there's that kind of...
bit of a standoff.
Yeah.
That's right. And ultimately, and as I said, Mitchevich is the one. He's the one that calls the shots in the hotel. And unfortunately, I was critical down the track of the persona of people may have looked at David of saying, well, David would have been instigated. He would have been a loudmouth. And I think that reputationally, that's...
You're
how
right.
people saw him.
Yeah.
But I think, you know, he's in the public eye, he's in the media, and, you know, you have two different faces, I think.
And also people made a lot of assumptions about Zdravko being a young Serbian boxer, weren't there? That he'd be aggressive, he'd be crazy, he's probably on steroids.
Yeah.
So you're right, in the community there were a lot of assumptions made about both of these guys.
Yeah, correct.
Mm.
And significantly, you know, this is, as I said earlier, this is one of the cases that was landmark. It was absolutely landmark because I had investigated a number, let's say five or six others, where we had bouncers and other people with one punches that people have died. And because of the way the law was then, that we couldn't prove a dangerous act. And basically, here is one, because he was a boxer of some skill, appreciating the damage a bare fist can do to a face and what damage, the potential damage, that when we looked at that with the Director of Public Prosecutions, it was Paul Coughlin in those days, we sat down with it and said, you know what, let's give it a run. And you make these decisions, you're either going to get bad, what we call case law, or good case law to support you. And that was the very first case in those circumstances that we charged someone with a manslaughter based on previous other cases we could only charge them with the serious assaults. Believe it or not, the fact that someone had died, but the way the law was structured, we have to prove an unlawful and dangerous act. Now, I could prove unlawful because as the investigation went on, he, being Mitchevich, claimed self-defence. He said that David had hit him. And so everyone's got the right to defend themselves, but it's got to be proportionate. So he's saying that he assaulted me, he being Mitchevich, said, this guy assaulted me. I then struck him back, and it's self-defence.
Mm-hmm.
But as it went on, you know, we're gathering the evidence. And you go where the evidence takes you and the facts that we had it. So at that particular time, David's on life support. We had this guy in custody, he's charged with the assault. We have a meeting with the DPP, Paul Coughlin, and it was then decided between the DPP. They give advice at that stage. They can't direct us because at that particular stage of the investigation, we make the decisions. But we certainly rely on their advice. And their advice was speaking to Paul. And I said, look, because of these reasons, him being a boxer, let's charge him with the manslaughter. So he's in custody for the assault. once a heartbreaking decision is made to turn the life support off, and he dies. The day after, we then charged him with the manslaughter, and subsequently got bail. So and then went on from there. And
so the DPP was supportive of your decision to make this sort of revolutionary charge to try this out.
Absolutely.
You got no pushback. I was no pushback with that, because it's pretty bold. Gutsy. Yeah,
absolutely. And that's you know, when you look at Paul Colgan, as we know, is a Supreme Court judge now, and he always has been supportive of us, and we had a great relationship between the Homicide Squad and the DPP. They are eventually the ones that will prosecute it, and we often get legal advice from them, and their advice at times might be, well, look, you're not going to succeed. Our advice is that, but however, it's your decision. And the police then must make a decision based on that. But knowing full well, as a police officer, as an investigator, say, well, ultimately they're going to present it for prosecution. They'll go to the committal and stand up and say, they then make the decision at committal stage. They might say, well, look, Your Honour, we're not going to proceed. We're going to withdraw these charges. So you really take on board the advice you get. And this was landmark decision stuff from Paul and myself in saying, you know what, we've had a number of these, and certainly we had quite a number of one-punch deaths prior to that. And this was going to, you know, are we taking a stand? Yes, we are. And let's go from here. And then we are where we are today with the new legislation.
After the break, the contentious case goes to trial. Coming up on Australian True Crime, the defendant makes an unlikely request. But first, we ask Charlie if there were any eyewitnesses to the punch that ultimately killed David Hooks.
Look, there was quite a number. And then you had, obviously, this is the value of your witnesses, because you had Victorian cricket players there. So human nature, they're going to support their coach. You had the South Australian cricketers. They're going to be supportive of the other cricket mates from Victoria. Then you had a group within the hotel that were patrons. You can call them neutral, but they might have had a soft spot or a bad spot towards, they would have known Hooksy was. They would have supported or negated Hooksy. The most significant ones, witnesses I had, were a group of people who lived in Cowdery Street in their apartments looking over the balcony. Because at that stage, the Beaconsfield Hotel was quite a problem for the local people because of the noise. They wanted it shut down and this type of stuff. So when there was a fracas outside, these people came out. So I would call them the most independent people. They didn't know who was who. They were looking down at that. So I'll paint the picture for you. So ultimately, Zdravko, with a few other bouncers, gets the group out. And David was leaving, and they went to get his car. No, I'm leaving. Yeah, leave me alone. And he was being told by David's mates and ladies, look, leave him alone, he's going. We're just going to get his car. He's going, leave him alone. And they're walking. They're about 90 metres from the front door. And initially I thought, hello, this guy's beyond his authority, that being the bouncer. Then when you do the investigation, you can't be jumping to the conclusion. So that was your first reaction, but then you got to support it in some way. And then when I go into the investigation, we find out part of their licence is the bouncers had to come outside of the hotel to keep the amenity of the area, basically saying, guys, keep it down. This is a residential area. It was part of the license. They had to, by their license, say, you've got to keep the noise down. And they were allowed to come out and say, guys, keep it down, keep it down. Unfortunately, it could have been resolved by the guys were leaving, guys, the cricket guys were leaving, Zdravko going back in the hotel. But it's the old fire and oxygen. The two clashed, as you said, similarly to before. Is it a bravado thing? We mix alcohol into that, and it just goes on from that point. And, you know, as it went on, Zdravko claimed self-defence. So we've got the two people, Zdravko and Hooksy, verbalising. You've got a group of people on the roadway, different groups, the patrons, other bouncers, and the two cricket groups, all looking at these two people. They're looking at them. Also, in the balcony, you've got four or five witnesses looking down above this group, a bird's eye view.
Like a helicopter.
Oh, that's right.
Yeah, so I've got that. So this is fantastic. Now, Zdravko comes up with the excuse, I punched him in self-defence. Mm-hmm. At a conservative estimate, the amount of witnesses on the ground were probably 25, 30-odd, probably, and the four or five on the balcony. As Ravko comes up and he says, the guy who was balding, he had a white T-shirt on, he grabbed me by the front of my shirt, he pulled me down and punched me in the abdomen. I then punched him back. And that was the coup de grace that David was knocked unconscious standing up.
Oh, wow.
And then hit his head.
Jeez. Yeah. Now, because, I say that because ultimately it is in all of us as human beings that if we trip, automatically your hand goes out and you, no matter what direction you are, you suppress your fall if you're conscious.
Yeah.
But David wasn't. He just copped it on the chin. He got a left hook from Zdravko. So you can imagine from a standing position going down and hitting the roadway.
Oh, yeah.
That was quite significant. So he then claimed that, and then they eventually dispersed and the ambulance came and the police then arrived and away we went from there. Not one witness supported the assertion that David had touched the bouncer in any way.
Oh, in any way? Not even grabbed his shirt?
No, nothing. Nothing at all. So then you've got to balance your credibility, because doing investigations, credibility of witnesses. You might say, well, yeah, the cricketers are going to say David did nothing. Mm. Well, yeah, but you're going to be biased. Some patrons, you don't know who they support, they could be biased. Mm. The other bouncers, they could be biased. But the independency of the people looking from the top, they're not biased in any way. They don't know who the groups are.
Mm-hmm.
So other bouncers who were some distance away, patrons, two cricket groups, and independent people, not one of those persons said that the guy in the white T-shirt touched the guy with the tabard around his neck. Oh. So there was no self-defence. It was only brought up by Zdravko and not supported or corroborated in any way. So I thought I'm pretty safe ground here. So we look at our manslaughter requirements, an unlawful and dangerous act. So I say it's unlawful because it's not self-defence. Now, my problem was, is it a dangerous act?
Punching someone is dangerous,
correct,
isn't it?
But you then, as we know, the intricacies and the complexities of the law and other case histories are so dangerous. Does anyone expect to kill anyone with one punch? No, they don't. However, because he was a boxer, you know, we sat there, we being Paul and I sat there and we made this decision to say, you know what, we need to go down this path. And it was high profile, as we all know.
Yeah,
you had all eyes on you.
Exactly, yeah. Exactly. And it wasn't because of that. It could have been anyone. But the whole thing is we had to take a stance after all the deaths we've had prior to that to say, you know what, we don't have a legislation. We give it a run. Let's let a jury decide.
And there was also a real focus on bouncers getting a bit out of control.
It was.
At the time, yeah.
And I don't think much has changed because I think you touched on it earlier, Michelle. It's a matter of psychology. It's a matter of two bulls in a pen.
Yeah.
They're not backing down. It's like when I was policing. You know, you then learnt. You learnt your bread and butter. We used to do the pub walkthroughs. That was the show me age, the old 10 o'clock closing days, and which was good stuff. And where we are today, 24/7. Yeah. So you'd walk through the pub. You know, things were a lot quieter in those days. We don't have the young police officer today just going from job to job. They don't get the chance to be proactive. So we used to do the pub walkthroughs through Footscray when I was there, and you know, you don't go to this guy and say, mate, finish your beer, get out of here.
Yeah.
Or because he's got his mates, and then becomes a standoff between two bulls in a ring. You go there, g'day guys, how are you going? You come quite friendly, and they say, no guys, look, they got half hour grace in those days. Look, guys, and you walk through, and then you might get some, look, I just bought that pot, I'm going to finish it. Yeah, hey, no problem. It's no problem at all. And we then disappear out the back with a licensee and have a couple of lemonades. And it didn't come out because you know you
That's
do not.
That's a bullshit alarm going off just then.
Yeah, that was. You got me. You must have a little button under there, isn't it?
Didn't there used to be lock-ins as well for special lock-ins for.
Yeah. So, you know, because you know. He doesn't want to be bit. You do not belittle someone in front of his group.
I know. Yeah. Because sometimes when you're embarrassed, you will just do something crazy.
Correct.
I mean, embarrassments can be a really bad trigger for people, right?
Yeah. Peer group pressure. Yeah. How am I going to be viewed? Well, I'm the leader of the pack. Depends how you stand. So you give him that leeway. Then, and that may escalate, it may not. And I tell you what, my 38 years, touch wood, and hopefully it continues on. I've never had a fisticuff fight in a hotel or anywhere because you used your mouth instead of anything else. You use the psychology because you say, you know what, this guy's going to be treated with respect. And it's like people used to say to me, well, look, all the work you've done throughout the police force in homicide and drug squad, internal investigations and armed robbery, etc., don't you fear for your life or you fear for your... And I say, no, I don't. People in the community have stopped me and said, oh, Mr. Bazina, how are you going? And you know straight away, when they start calling you Mr. Bazina, you know it's going to be a crook of some sort. So you turn around. And I had her on a train when my daughter was quite young, and you don't recall them because you deal with so many. You said, you don't remember me. No, I don't. Oh, my name's so. Oh, g'day, how you going? You locked me up for that murder, you know, 15. And because you treated them with respect. So there's no axe to grind. And oh, what are you doing with yourself these days? And nothing changed. But unfortunately, putting old head on young shoulders of the police officers of today is a big issue. So going through a hotel and you then say, okay, finish up, guys. Let's say they don't finish this. They're going to push the envelope a bit. Then it becomes, you then can come back out and say, guys, look, fair's fair. This guy's got to close up the hotel. He's got this. Otherwise, we've got to charge him. Or he'll be in trouble for letting people on his premises. Look, you've got to go. And you give him a couple more chances. But when push comes to shove, then you give them that leeway and then you explain things and then it becomes a bit of a tussle. These guys aren't going. Well, then you call in the cavalry, then you do it that way. Mm. And then you can have an argument and say, well, I gave you every opportunity. It's how you treat people.
Mm.
And ultimately, you treat people with respect, you're not going to have a problem. And
which again, though, this takes me back to the bouncer situation. So they are at the front line as well.
Yep.
You know, of this terrible behaviour. As you say, now that bars are open, well, not in Sydney, but in Melbourne still, you know, open a lot and people aren't just drinking beer anymore.
Correct.
My dad, who was a taxi driver for his whole life, said, you know, he saw the change when people stopped drinking beer and started drinking Red Bull and vodka and stuff. Yeah. He saw the level of violence and craziness change. And so bouncers are on the front line of that. They must be hyper-vigilant as well.
Well, they are. But
it's a stressful job.
Yeah, I know, but unless they're... You know, when I did that, the Hooksy investigation, I looked at their training. I actually got the training manual of what actually they're taught. And even from, you know, one of my issues was at the hotel was, okay, you've arrived as a bouncer. The bouncer becomes an agent for that complex, for that, well, here in this case, the Beaconsfield Hotel. One of my questions was to the manager or the licensee, what instructions did you give to these guys about the way you want them to conduct and run your organisation, run the business? Now, not that those days wasn't very much at all. Oh, well, they've got the bouncers coming on. We've got four guys coming on. We're just paying them. Okay, you know what to do. See you later. These people have to take ownership. Sit down with their agents because they represent the organisation, the company they're working for. And, okay, you've got and it's a dangerous situation.
And he's 22.
Exactly.
In his training.
Exactly. And no psychology, no this, no that. Okay, we charged Zdravko with a manslaughter and... what we have to prove in manslaughter as opposed to murder. We just couldn't get up on the dangerous act because no one expects. So the jury accepted it wasn't a dangerous act.
They accepted that he could not have known that he could have killed David Hooks, even though he was a boxer, even though he knew the power of his punches.
And the defence was, basically, it's not a dangerous act. No one expects to kill anyone with one blow.
Really?
But to come back and come back with not guilty or charged with a common assault. Because the only person in this whole group was Zdravko saying it was self-defence. No one supports that. So, and this is the issue with juries. I've become critical of them. We don't know what happens in jury rooms. We're not entitled against the law to question any juror. So we don't know what happens in that jury room. And they come back with a total acquittal for the common assault. Sure, I can understand the manslaughter. But the common assault to say, well, hang on, he's saying that he was self-defence, but we've got 50 witnesses looking at the one incident and not one person has supported what he said. So you walk away and, you know, just you live with the decision of juries.
You couldn't get that either. So a 13-day trial he had for the manslaughter and was found not guilty.
On everything,
On everything, and you couldn't get him for common assault either.
Not even that.
Do you think you could get someone on manslaughter now that in the interim we've had so many campaigns about one punch can kill?
And it's widely recognised as,
Well, now the beauty of that is if I had a David Hooks today, he would be convicted because the legislators, the politicians have created... finally, the new law that They then say a dangerous act is when someone attacks someone that doesn't see it coming from behind, the coward punch.
Okay.
So you tick that box. So it's an unlawful act because it's not self-defence. And the legislators now say if someone gets coward punched, they do not see it coming, that's a dangerous act. So your 2 points of proof for manslaughter are fulfilled. And now that carries a mandated sentence of 10 years for a coward punch. This is where we've got to say, you say to the, you know, sports clubs I speak to the young colts, A, look after your people. Keep your hands in your pockets if the situation extends, because they get into fights, but that one blow and you live that for the rest of your life.
There's a lot of education happening around
Fantastic.
That.
Exactly.
Really good stuff. And the language change from remember the king hit, which elevated it to some hero. Sometimes people would feel good to this coward punch, which I think's, and that's really only in the last 10 years, not even, I think, that language has changed.
Under 10 years.
Yeah.
Absolutely. But, you know, funny, you know, with the wording of things, you know, the coward punch, and I read in the media probably, which surprised me, but this, again, doesn't surprise me because of the world we live in today. There was a case, wherever it was, I don't know, that this guy was charged and identified in the media. He's been charged with a coward punch, et cetera, et cetera. Mm. Well, he got acquitted. He got acquitted, whatever case it was.
Yeah.
But the point of that story was, he then sued some media organisations and stuff because he was labelled as a coward punch.
Yes, I did read that.
And
yes.
So that's where the world we live in. And all of a sudden, so this labelling of people, of course, that's why it's all about, now, I'll go back a step. Investigators are the collector of facts. We collect the facts, either inculpatory or exculpatory. We present it to the court. It's the court is the only body that proves innocence or guilt. That's why it's alleged this person did it. He's an accused person. Mm-hmm. It's all because everyone's innocent or proven guilty beyond reasonable doubt. So we collect the facts, we give it to the courts, and they make the decision based on the evidence. But unfortunately, in the adversarial system we live under in our court system, juries get censored evidence. That's how, you know, significance become.
Yeah.
You sit there with deceased families, and one of my things I'd say to the deceased families, you sit from day one, and relationships you build with them, you say the most important person in this courtroom is the accused person. It's his or her rights have to be protected, and we have to prove it. He has to say nothing, she has to say nothing, and it's beyond reasonable doubt that 12 strangers have to come up with one decision. You try doing that at a dinner party.
Yeah. Oh, my God, it's getting harder and harder, right?
And Misevic, he was found not guilty.
Yeah.
He expressed quite sincere remorse to David Hooks's family afterwards, didn't he?
I remember his father coming, because I then had a relationship with his father, and we'd stay in contact, and he wanted to, his father would wanted to, he and his and Zdravko to go and see Robin and Terry Hooks or Terry Cranage, and apologise. And I said, you know what, it's too raw for you to go there. But that's the remorse that they showed and the devastation that they had on the Misevic family. So it's a sad case. We've got the situation with David and his family. Mm. We've got a situation. It's a matter of that magic word. And the amount of people and groups I speak to, it's that magic word of regret. You can't take back the spoken word or the action. You can be sorry is all you like, but it's regret. I shouldn't have done that. But thinking, either getting out of the haze of the alcohol, getting out of the haze of the drugs, getting out of the haze of the adrenaline on a situation, and you need the support from your own group to be able to say, you know what, pull your head in, let's just go.
Yeah.
But it's a big thing to say, especially the bull in the bull ring, with the two bulls in there, to be able to back down. No one likes to do it, but you know what? I'd rather wake up in the morning and say, geez, I'm glad I did what I did. I just walked away.
And there's not much you could do in that situation. An apology is about the biggest thing you could do. To offer to apologise to their faces is pretty brave.
Absolutely. And that's how sincere they were.
Yeah.
And this is the type of families you deal with. And, you know, we support deceased families and offenders' families. And that come to a shock to his father and his family. And they were, you know, generally remorseful and wanted to do it well, you know, days into the investigation. I want to do that, Charlie. I want to go there. Look, you can't. They're just too raw to do that. And time went on, but they were genuinely remorseful. And, you know, some can say, well, that was the best result.
Mm. I'm seeing here that Robin Hooks, David Hooks' widow, also sued the Misevic family and also their employers, Peter Clark Agencies, who owned the pub.
Right.
And then they settled at some stage during that proceeding. Yeah. And the settlement has been kept secret.
Yeah. Mm. Yeah. But again, you know, it doesn't. I suppose it gives you accountability.
Yeah, that's right.
And hopefully other people can look at it and say, you know what? And that was my message then and now, to say people who contract people in to work on their behalf, they have to take that responsibility.
Thank you for downloading this episode of Australian True Crime. We'll be back next week.